Very much, and especially the remaining two Beethoven Quartet concerts that are going on. Two of them have already taken place, and there's two more, one tonight at the Hamilton Studio and one on Sunday afternoon at the Barrister Winery. It's the early beginning of Beethoven's 250th birthday party, which many organizations are going to be doing. The symphony is going to have an all Beethoven concert here in January coming along, and pretty good stuff to celebrate. And there's great celebration in these quartet concerts, amazing quartet concerts that are going on with the Ariel Quartet. Two members of the quartet are here, the violist, Jan Gruning. Hello, Jan.
Hello.
And also the violinist, Gershon Getchikoff.
Good morning, close. Hi.
And welcome to you. And it's kind of fun, just right off the bat, that with your quartet, we don't say the first violinist or the second violinist, because you folks have this tradition of simply being the two violinists playing
Correct.
Whichever part you need to play.
Yes.
Is it kind of a new tradition to do you think? Is it happening quite a bit?
I think it's happening a little bit more today than it did when we started about two decades ago. In fact, one of my favorite quartet childhood stories was when we played for the Amadeus Quartet. We had the great fortune of having a few summers working with the three members of the Amadeus Quartet when they were still alive. And we had a very stern conversation with the first violinist, Norbert Breinin, who said that, you know, this is all nice and well, but you have to choose because, you know, it's a role. You have to get into the role and you have to be that. And of course, he was 100% correct. But I think since essentially the very beginning, when we were 13, 14, when we started the quartet, we switched just out of, you know, the curiosity of discovering both parts. And, you know, it's the same instrument. So, of course, it was natural for us to be curious about both parts. So I think in our case, because we sort of grew into both parts simultaneously, that's something that works and something that we love doing, and in a way enriches the quartet in many aspects. And we both play first violin parts differently because we also play second violin parts and vice versa. But today it's becoming a little bit more common, still not very common, but a little bit more common. I think the Emerson Quartet switching probably contributed to that. It depends on the quartet. Each quartet decides what works for them.
And as I sat in the concert on Tuesday night listening, I did kind of wonder, do you ever arm wrestle over who's going to play which part? Somebody's really, really wanting to play that part.
I think probably most times that we do kind of express specific desires for a part would be the second violin part, actually, for certain pieces. I'm, for example, a huge fan of second violin parts in Mendelssohn quartets. And there are other examples, too. But otherwise, I think generally the approach is we try to more or less divide the repertoire equally so that we all have we all wet our feet in both parts in all facets of the repertoire. So that's just generally the guideline. And then occasionally one would have a preference here and there, and we try to,
Then, Jan, you're the only violist, so you don't have that issue.
I don't, yes.
but you get to watch the violinists play. And so right in front of Gershon here, can you say that you find differences in how you might play with one versus the other on a certain kind of line they would play?
I don't think I would. I don't think I play differently. I think the main reason for that is that one of the key important things for all four of us is, I think, to maintain our personalities and our individual approach to playing. And so I think with that in mind, we don't switch anything in our attitude. I think that if it feels different because there's a different person leading the majority, and I say that because on the one hand side we are all leading at the same time, but For, I guess it's fair to say, the majority of the string quartet repertoire, there is there needs to be a first violinist who is in charge of initiating or has a fair share of initiating the responsibility just by the nature of the part. And that is a very complex issue. That's why I'm tiptoeing around it a little bit, because we could talk about it for a very long time, at least.
Oh, we needn't.
But that's I guess, as well as I can put it right now.
Yeah, no, I understand. Yeah, because in hearing it, just the kind of two different personalities of the two violinists, and that was really a great thing. And in being a listener to the concert when I heard it on Tuesday night, talking with members of the Ariel Quartet, who have two more concerts in their Beethoven cycle, which they're doing for us. And the other thing that we simply have to talk about is your longevity, and you're not old people. So is it just the same four members for the entire history of this group?
No, not quite. I'm the violist. I joined about 8-9 years ago, and there was a violist before me. Otherwise, Gershon would have no validity in claiming 2 decades of working together. But I joined about 9 years ago. But the original violist who decided to leave was the only founding member who is not currently in the group. So all other three people are founding members. And did start around 2000. We are about to celebrate our 20th anniversary in 2020. Wow. So it's not only a big year for Beethoven.
Big year for your quartet. So
yes, not that it matters equally as much, but it feels like a long time for us. And we will, I think, use that occasion that is important for our own career to highlight Beethoven's career. So I think that way this is for us, as servants of the music, the best way to express our joy of having the luck to play together for such a long time.
Thank you. Thank you really for getting us back on track in a certain way, because it would be fun to sit here and kind of talk about the dynamics of an ensemble. I, too, have been in a long-term ensemble that's gone through its 7-year itch, and it's this and it's that, and it's stayed together through different thick and thin and all kinds of things. But let's let that go. The quartet been going for a long time. And I think it's kind of significant that your 20th and Beethoven's 250th are all happening in the same year. So as much as it's ever possible to talk about music, you know, as you know, so whatever we can say is less than experiencing the music. And I don't even know where to start, because so much is said. It is the essential thing. It is the core of what you do. I don't know. What do you talk to somebody that maybe doesn't understand that when you try to express how important Beethoven quartets are to the existence of your group?
Yeah, I remember we just had another interview a while ago, and we were talking about kind of the composers that are kind of the most fundamental for the genre, for the medium. And of course, it's very difficult to say, because to take any one of the so many composers that wrote for the genre would be a sin. And yet, I think there's probably two composers that I can say that without them, really, the string quartet sound would not have been established as it had been established, which are Haydn and Beethoven. Haydn being kind of the pioneer in sort of treating the medium as a standalone important medium, that's not kind of a thing you do at home when you don't have nothing better to do. He kind of solidified the structure of the quartet, the main relationships of the voicing, and really the kind of the nature of the beats altogether. But at the same time, without Beethoven quartets, no other quartet that has been written after him would have existed in the same way. Beethoven created a quartet language, just like he created a symphony language. You know, then if we go to specifics, that's already going to, you know, the grammar of music and everything. And I don't know if that's the right place to do it or the right time. But certainly there are elements in his writing that have fundamentally solidified how a string quartet speaks. And that has translated to everything that was written since.
And yet, we can either go away, the incredible diversity of what Beethoven did in writing for the string quartet. If a pianist wanted to argue whether there's a greater stylistic breadth within all the 32 piano sonatas or within the 16 quartets, but I wonder if the quartets maybe have a greater breadth that you can't say, oh, that sounds like a Beethoven quartet for how extremely different they are.
I think what makes the set of quartets sort of stand out, maybe if we do compare them to the sonatas, is that for Beethoven, from the very beginning, the quartet medium was already established in his mind as one of the pinnacles of genres in music. And so he did not experiment lightly with this genre. And in fact, he delayed publishing his first set of quartets until he was 30.
Writing them, yeah. He delayed writing them.
He delayed writing them, and he worked on them for a long time, and he published them when he was 30, which sounds, you know, 30, very young, but it's actually, he wrote so much already before. And so really when we're looking at the quartets, we're from the very first Opus 18 to the very last 135, these are all complete masterpieces that Beethoven put a huge amount of work and thought into. And so in that sense, they're maybe more representable of who Beethoven is in a way, because when we look at, for example, some of the early piano sonatas, and when you look at other composers such as you know, even Mozart, we look at some of his earlier quartets, it's great music. It's not yet that mastery that we see when we're looking at the 10 so-called 10 celebrated quartets of Mozart, or when we're looking at the middle sonatas or certainly the late sonatas. There was a natural process that composers went through during their work when they started writing for certain genres. But with Beethoven and quartets, that process started from a different place.
Yeah.
His language and his music making was already at a very refined and defined for himself, for his character and for his style level when he wrote already his first Opus 18.
Yeah, I mean, he mainly made a name for himself. He turned 30 right around, I mean, born in 1770, he turned 30 right around 1800, 1801, which is when the quartets are published in 1801, 1802. So that's right around the time that he wrote that. In the previous 6-7 years that he had already lived in Vienna, he mostly made a name for himself through his piano playing, his improvising, and the piano sonatas that he wrote. So I think and his father very much tried to bring him out as a piano wunderkind, because Mozart was the preceding one to look up to and to go for, and trying to copy Beethoven into that image. I think playing the piano became his natural immediate outlet, and so I think what Gershon is saying, yeah, is true for the quartets.
Yeah. Earlier, Gershon, you were speaking that very early in the history of this quartet, you were coached by members of the Amadeus Quartet, and people say Amadeus Quartet with very hushed tones and great respect. I know the very secret love that people have for that ensemble. So now you plural, in being a very mature quartet that's been through a lot, how much do you have that legacy of the world of quartet history still haunting you, still affecting you, versus what you've found just simply by getting that music out and playing those notes and trying to think about Beethoven, mm-hmm. of legacy versus what you discover when you're working on it?
Yeah, I think that that's a very interesting question. I think for everybody it's different. I can only speak for my view and my understanding of how I see we fit into that question and to that answer, is that I think that we are incredibly grateful for what we have, the knowledge that we have inherited through this wisdom and through this legacy from quartets like the Amadeus Quartet, as well as the La Salle Quartet, the Cleveland Quartet. These are all traditional lines that go back very far, very deep, and in very different directions. And so I think one of the most rewarding things for us is to feel like at the one hand side, these blend together in what we do because of the education we have received. But on the other hand side, we try to just look at the composer, and the composer and the composition is the most important thing. And we try to distill what we think the essence of it is, and it changes all the time. That's, I think, the most fascinating and rewarding thing about our work, that we get to live with it. And so as that evolves, I think I wouldn't say that I'm aware of continuing a tradition. I think I just do what I love, and I am what I am because of what I've learned or what I've experienced. But I don't know how you.
Yeah, Gershel.
I think I'm not sure it's a necessarily a different perspective, but I sort of look at this. Like I look at many things as in that string quartet playing is a language, and it's a language that we were very fortunate to learn from very early on from several different, like Jan said, legacies. The way we speak quartets today is a direct result of that. It's like a child learning how to speak because they heard their parents speak. But at the same time, or not at the same time, and then with that language, we then come to a piece of music and you know, we're like an actor taking a script. And at that point, you can't really look at other actors and sort of see what exactly they did here, what exactly they did there, because you have to form a personal identification and intuitive connection with the work. You have to sort of internalize it. You have to be able to make sense of it intellectually, emotionally. You have to understand the narrative of the piece. And so I've, for example, make a habit of, when we're learning a new work, to not listen to any other recordings during the learning process. And as soon as the learning process has sort of reached a certain minimal sort of level that I feel like, okay, I'm in that piece, I can then go and see, well, it's interesting what this quartet did, what that quartet did, and then I can get inspired, I can get ideas. But it's very important for me not to interfere with that initial process of creating a individual personal connection with a piece, both on an individual level, me, myself, as well as the group as a whole. So I think both channels kind of exist at the same time. They don't interfere with one another. It's, you know, we grew up with learning from the best, and now we use that as our tool and our language to explore the works that we're playing.
I like that you just speak of it as a language. So if we assume that the language of a string quartet, the language that you four share, then the issue becomes the audience, when they come in to hear you, how do they know that language? Is it like a bunch of Americans going to an Italian opera with no subtitles and not knowing what is said on stage or not, and especially in something as frankly dense as three Beethoven quartets in a concert? What can you do to try to bridge that gap, that the audience has such a different range of understanding that language?
It's interesting that you mentioned opera, actually. Keep your hold your thought, but because just in the genre of opera, we went through so many over the last couple of centuries. We went through so many different opinions of composers who thought, you know, what's more important, the music or the message or both. And so I think that's a very interesting person. Go ahead.
For me, this question is always an interesting one to talk about because there's so many levels to this. But I often make the parallel between music and theater. And theater or film, for that matter. And, you know, we go to a movie, we go to see a movie, or we go to see a play in the theater, and we are never expected to understand, even though you're dealing with literal imagery and language and everything. We're not expected to understand. We're expected to like the movie or not like the movie. That's the question that normally people ask other people when after they've seen a movie. Did you like it or not? They never ask whether you understood it or not. And I think that's a very it's very interesting that we have this perception that that music is something that we need to understand in order to be able to enjoy it. And I don't think that's true. I think that Western music as a whole, we understand the basic grammar of it because the language of tonality is something that we're surrounded by since day one, whether it be Beethoven or Britney Spears, for that matter. It's the same underlining all of those forms of music is the same language of tonality, which is at the basis of the vast majority of Western music as we know it. And so we already have that foundation. And from there on, it's only a matter of whether the composer and then the performer, same like the director or the script writer and the actors and the film making process as a whole or the theater play directors, whether they were able to create a coherent representation of a piece of work. And that coherency is very, that's a whole other topic of what makes something coherent or not, but it's not something that needs to be understood intellectually, I find, by the audience. It's something that probably needs to be at least on a certain level understood intellectually by the performers, but it's something that if it's there, the audience member will react. They will perceive something that would make sense to them emotionally, first of all. Not intellectually. And I think that's what we're going for, first of all. We want to make sure that when we're presenting something on stage, that it can be perceived by a four-year-old. And it will be perceived. We often play, kids concerts for certain outreach events or things like this, which I always love because that's always the greatest mirror. If you're able to grab their attention and keep their attention for the 6-7 minutes that you're playing a movement, then you're doing something right because they will not lie. If you don't grab their attention, they will show it immediately. And when you can do that, you realize that there's nothing intellectual is there. It's just whether you're creating something that's coherent enough to grab a listener's attention.
Yeah, I think that's very true. Also, for example, if we took the last movement that we're going to play in our visit here to Spokane, which is the last movement of Beethoven's Opus 135 Quartet, which is the last work he ever wrote. It is a movement that is entitled Der schwer gefasste Entschluss, which is German for describing a difficult process to reach a decision. And it has two contrasting parts to it. One is adagio, a slow movement, which is very grave in nature and in character. And he wrote, which is very, very unusual for him, he wrote words to it, which is, muss es sein, does it have to be, and it mirrors the rhythm. If one speaks German, that's, I think, very enriching to understand and to know that. And then there's an offsetting, celebratory, very lighthearted allegro part, which is, es muss sein, it must be, and that's the answer. And so I think that on the one hand side, you know, intellectually, it is satisfying to know about it, and certainly as a performer, one needs to know about it. But as an audience member, I'm not sure. I think it's interesting. I wouldn't doubt that it would interest most people. But at the other side, you have a very intuitive access to the character of the slow part and to the character of the fast part and how they interact with one another. And I think that's the mastery of Beethoven, that he puts it into a music that you don't need to have the words to. So.
I think that's a good place to leave it because that will be where the Ariel Quartet leaves it on the Sunday afternoon concert. It's Sunday afternoon at 3:00 at the Barrister Winery for their final concert. But then tonight, it's a concert at the Hamilton Studio, which is on, I think, 1427 West Dean Street. And that will be, and so there will be two opportunities to hear this quartet in this amazing music, Jan Gruning and Gershon Getzinger. Thank you very, very much for
Thank you
for spending this time with
us. Thank you.